You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Welcome, everybody, to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe 12-hour Patreon thank you live stream on Saturday, January 23rd, 2021. It is a new year, and we're hopefully at the tail end of what's been a really challenging, you know, pandemic. There's a lot going on. We're not ready to celebrate yet, but this, I think, will be a great way to start off 2021. What do you guys think?
Absolutely.
It feels different. It feels like it's just a different time, you know, than it was last year.
Did you feel your chest somewhat unclenched? Just a yeah, little bit.
Sphincters were unclenched.
Just a, it was like a little bit like, okay.
Yeah. So obviously, most of the people who are watching the stream probably know the SGU well. But, you know, if you have guests, family members, people you're introducing to the show, if you stumbled upon this somehow on YouTube or Facebook, we are a science and skeptical podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. We have also published a book by the same name. So we have the usual crew, what we call the Skeptical Rogues. I'm Stephen Novella, the producer of the show. To my left is Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
To my right is Jay Novella.
Hi.
And to the far right is George Robb, who's not a regular member of the show, but George is a good friend of the SGU and of us personally, of course. He joins us for a lot of things. He hosts our Skeptical Extravaganza. George hosts his own podcast, the Geologic Podcast. And he often joins us for our live events.
I'm an irregular guest
You're
of the show.
An irregular guest.
Oh, yes.
You got to see your doctor about that.
And, of course, now, we have Bob and Kara with us. Bob and Kara are with us remotely. I did want to start off just by talking a little bit about a few things. But first, what we are and what we do, what's this all about? So we are...
What's it all about, love?
What's this thing called, love? What we do, we call scientific skepticism, a term that we say was popularized by Carl Sagan. We don't want to say that he coined it because other people used it before him. But I think it really became sort of popularly known and used with Sagan. And we've taken that sort of as the philosophical sort of core of our movement. And what it is exactly has evolved over the years. Right now, what I would say our focus is promoting scientific literacy, critical thinking, and media literacy. You have to throw in media literacy because that really is a separate entity unto itself, especially now with social media and everything. It's such a huge factor in what we do that it is really a skill set unto itself. And so we're trying to promote all of those three things working together. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when Carl Sagan was talking about what is scientific skepticism, he was pretty much talking about scientific literacy. And then over the years, we added the critical thinking piece, and not only just us as science communicators, scientific skeptical communicators, the skeptical movement, but also researchers, you know, psychological researchers, looking at the question of how do you get people to stop believing in things that are not true and to believe things that are true, to basically align their beliefs more with reality. Because that's ultimately what we're trying to do, align our beliefs with reality. And it became pretty clear that the science knowledge deficit model, while not completely incorrect, was dramatically incomplete. And we had to add the critical thinking component to it. And now I think we also have to add the media savvy, media literacy component to it as well. So that's what we do. That's what our podcast is modeled after. George, that's what your podcast is largely modeled after as well, though you have... Why don't you tell us a little bit about your poop jokes,
I think, than maybe...
You have more poop jokes?
Yeah, I think more poop jokes, yeah. No, what's nice, though, is that basically our job is pretty much done. You know, I think we've achieved the goals we've wanted to achieve, and I'm going to stop my show because, you know, everyone's... It's just gone so perfectly well over the last 10, 12, 15 years
that we've been doing. Conspiracy theories, done.
Yeah.
Anti-vaxxers, they're done.
I mean, it's like...
Alternative medicine.
Yeah, people are just not...
Case closed.
Yeah, they are checking their sources. They are posting things that they are sure are true. Not from specious sources, and it's it's nice.
I mean, imagine. I know that the skeptical movement and people that do what we do have an impact.
I mean, it, you know, it's simply from the people that we talk to, you know, we all are in touch with our audience.
It's like a seatbelt on a crashing plane.
Yeah.
Too late.
No, it makes you, if we weren't doing this, though, it makes you wonder.
Yeah.
Because there is a huge wave of influence that people have.
Imagine if skeptics weren't here. Like, because we're the back pressure. We're the thing that keeps trying to push them down. So, you know, with skepticism, more now than ever, it's always going to be needed. The pseudoscience is never going to go away.
Yeah, so, you know, this obviously is something we think about, talk about quite a bit. You know, things are, from some dimensions, some perceptions, measures, getting worse over the last 20 years on our watch. What does that mean? All we could really say is they probably would have gotten even more worse if it weren't for the skeptical movement. Us, you know, interfacing with the media, building a movement of people who are, you know, increasing their knowledge of scientific literacy and critical thinking, et cetera. So I think we're having an impact. I do think that as small as we are numbers-wise, we have a disproportionate effect on journalists, on the media. You know, we do get a lot of attention, you know, way beyond our numbers, which is good. But, and of course, you can't rerun history and say, wow, what would things have been like, you know, had there not been a skeptical movement? What you can do is look at different societies, though, and you can see how bad it can get. There are societies in which, like, pseudoscientific or metaphysical beliefs are so baked into the culture, everyone believes them pretty much, you know, and they're taken for granted. People who question that are literally like less than 1%. They are completely on the fringe. Also, if you look at some metrics, like if you look at scientific literacy over the last 20 years, it's actually increasing. You know, it's gone from like 15% to 25%. You know, it depends on where you draw the cutoff, but according to Miller, like he does that, he's been doing the same sort of test for 20 years of what he calls civic scientific literacy, like the minimal knowledge of science you need in order to be able to participate in a modern democratic society. And that has been steadily increasing over the last 20 years. So that's good. You know, that's one metric where things, you know, look good. In terms of people who do not consider themselves part of any like mainstream belief system, that's been growing as well. But we're not changing human nature, right? That's the one thing. We can't change people. We can't change human nature. But what we can do is give people the tools and the skills to, you know, to be the best people that they can be, specifically in the context, again, of aligning your belief with reality. Yeah, man, the forces aligned against us are huge and well-funded. You know, we feel like we got our finger in 1,000 dikes. You know, it's not one. It's, you know, many, many, many different topics, different fronts, different movements, different segments of society that are pushing against the role of science, critical thinking, you know, logic in the modern world. I also wanted to go through the panel today and talk about some of the other projects that we're doing, because you guys obviously all know that we do the Skeptics Guide. I do want to say, so the triggering of this show, the 12-hour show, this was our Patreon reward for hitting 4,000 patrons. Between the time that we hit that threshold and today, we are now at 4,566 patrons. So we've blown past the 4,000 threshold. So if you're not a patron, consider supporting Skepticism, the SGU, and if you want to see us do this for 24 hours, that's the way.
How do you do that? How do you do that, Steve? Where do you go to?
You go to patreon.com/skeptics.
And there's a panoply of payment options, right?
Oh yeah, you could get any amount. The amount's totally up to you. But there are different levels. At the $5 level, it's $5 per month. Then you get access to our Friday live stream recordings. So if you don't, if you're not available at the Friday live stream, you can watch them whenever. That's only for patrons. At the $8 level, that's the premium level or higher, obviously, then you get all of our premium content. And which, you know, there's over 100 items now of extra content, you know, extra bits from the show, videos, mostly audio. You also get the ad-free show. You get the ad-free version of the show.
And the satisfaction knowing that you're supporting.
That's the most. But George, yeah. You were telling us about the Geologic podcast. Tell us a little bit more about it and how people can support.
Oh, well, my podcast started just as something to do. It was never meant to be like a skeptical show. It was never meant to be a critically thinking embraced show. And somehow I landed in there. I just wanted to talk about stuff that was interesting to me, and skepticism in science is really interesting to me. So I managed to find an audience. I think my job within the skeptical community, the critical thinking community, is to just be a bit of a brain sorbet, between the shows that actually have legit content in terms of like scientific background, you know, that people that are educated in that kind of stuff, I have just a little bit of a comic relief here and there, and I'm about to do my 700th show, which I'm going to do live on the 6th of February. It's going to be a live YouTube show. The last time for 500, I did the live show here.
Yeah. That was smooth as silk.
500 minutes. That was 8 hours. The first 3 hours of which were literally done into my phone because there wasn't enough equipment here. That still is one of my favorite. Like, so how do you deal with a situation, a stressful situation?
Kara also has a podcast, Talk Nerdy. Kara, tell us all about your podcast and how people can support you.
I was just going to talk a little bit about Talk Nerdy, which I've been doing now since before I joined you guys. Mm-hmm. Did y'all know that?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So it was, I think I'm on episode 340, something like that. I do 50 episodes a year. So what does that mean? I'm coming up on 6 years, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, this year I'm really making a concerted effort on the show to ensure that I'm amplifying the voices of women scientists and scientists of color. For the most part, they are single, long form interviews. So my whole show is a different guest each week and we focus on a different topic. This past week I had Kat Arney, who's a British broadcaster, and we talked about cancer evolution, which is the topic of her most recent book. Before that was Shane Campbell Staton, and we talked about evolution in the Anthropocene. That one was fascinating. We were able to talk about his research into Mozambican elephants. He's been studying these elephants in Mozambique and looking at the rate of tusklessness in the elephants. And it seems to be that elephants are actually evolving tusklessness as a function, unfortunately, of the civil war there, because many people on both sides of the fight were funding their war through poaching. And so because more elephants were being poached, the elephants that were tuskless were surviving at a greater rate. Also, I've recently had Katie Mack, Angela Saini, Lulu Miller, a lot of really incredible scientists and science writers talking about all sorts of things, from the end of the universe to alternative facts, to the fact that trees actually migrate. And to, of course, as the guys on God Awful Movies love to point out, to a conversation about books bound in human flesh. Bob, you might like that one.
I have one right over here.
Only I'm not one? Surprised, Bob.
Only one.
Is he actually reaching
I think so. It happens to be within reach. Oh, there you go. Necronomicon.
That's the Necronomicon.
It's not really flesh, but it's pseudo flesh.
Yeah, well,
it's faux flesh.
Anything that's not flesh is pseudo flesh.
All right, you got me with the alliteration there. Good.
Yeah, so we did a whole episode with Megan Rosenbloom, who's a medical historian, talking about actual books found in human flesh and which ones are real, which ones are fake, where they exist, and what we know about them. So Talk Nerdy's been going strong for many, many years. Weekly interview show, deep dive, long form. And yeah, I hope you guys will check it out.
Kara, who's been like your top couple guests? Who's like been your like absolute top three guests?
Top three, like my favorite, or top three, like people loved it?
Your favorite.
Oh, gosh, that's so mean. You know, they always say it's like asking you to tell about your favorite children.
Five.
I loved it.
I know my favorite child is my daughter, my one
child. He has one child.
Yeah. No, his favorite child.
Oh, your favorite child. I thought you said you know who your favorite guest of my show.
Oh, gosh.
I was like, was it when I interviewed you?
Don't put me on the spot. You're on the spot, Kara.
So I have interviewed all the rogues, which is great, and George. So everybody here is well represented. I would say recent guests that I really, really loved were probably Adam Rutherford, where we talked about how to argue with a racist, and Angela Saini I loved, and of course Maria Konnikova, where we talked all about her newest book, Biggest Bluff, and basically that change that she's had in her career towards becoming a professional poker player. Like, this amazing psychologist who's been a writer for years decides to learn a little bit more about poker, and in doing so, you know, gets a seat at the World Series of Poker and
That's
wins
awesome.
A ton of money.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Kara, how do trees migrate?
Very slowly.
So, yeah, very slowly. I mean, yeah, that's the thing. You'd think we're talking about individual trees, but of course we're talking about global populations of trees. And when you look at the data over time, you see that actual populations of trees move as a function of climate change. So they are physically migrating generation after generation, and oftentimes moving either towards warmer climates, towards colder climates, up in elevation, down in elevation. And it can tell us a lot about what's happening on the planet is global tree migration.
Okay. And Kara, how can people support you? You were about to say that.
Right. So I do have a Patreon. You can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. You can also go to karasantamaria.com and you'll find all my work there. Talk Nerdy has its own website, talknerdy.com. So that's really easy. I've tried to make it as simple as possible. And also, I don't know if I've told you guys this, but I've been once a month going on God Awful Movies with Heath and Noah. And it's been really funny because Eli Bosnick loves to buy URLs and redirect to my website whenever there's a really bad joke. So you can also go to iloveskinbooks.com and it'll take you to Talk Nerdy as well.
Okay. Kara, do you have dearmotherofgod.com?
I should actually get Dear Mother of God because that is my Italian translation of my name. This is my first name. Cara means dear, Cara. Like aww. Beloved. Cara mia, my dear. And of course, Santa Maria is the mother of God.
That was the old Italian, like, what was that? Fungo, you know what I mean?
Pasta fagiola.
Did your family ever do that? The only person I knew who, like, legit did the Malocchia was our grandmother.
Yeah.
Where you do, like, you put a curse on something.
Yeah, it has a word.
Malocchia.
She did a spit, the little spit take, too. That,
like, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. She meant it. Like, she did it and meant it. Like, it wasn't ironic. All right, Evan.
Yes.
So you have also are a member of another podcast, Which Game First. Tell us a little. You've mentioned it before on the show, but give us the
point. I have. So Which Game First is a board game podcast in which myself as a co-host, along with four others of my real lifetime friends, have gotten together, and we review board games. We play the board games, and we review the board games. And we do them from all sorts of times, genres, types, card games. This is not video games. There's plenty of shows out there about video games. There are also a lot about board games as well, but we take a little bit of a different take on it with our review program. So we'd love for you to check us out at Which Game First. And we also do have a Patreon account. It's simple. We have one level of sponsorship. It's $3 a month. That's it. That's all we're asking for the people to support us. So $3 a month. There is a connection to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, a direct connection besides myself. Celeste DeAngelis, she is the host of the show, and she is Perry's sister. I knew Celeste before I knew Perry. It was through Celeste that I met Perry. And this is before I met you guys, because I met you guys through my association with Perry many years later. So Celeste and I actually go way back. It's a beautiful thing because even though Perry is gone, I still see sort of parts and components and features of Perry in Celeste. There's definitely two different people, but there are some similarities there. You just can't help but notice and be charmed and, you know, love it because it's a little piece of Perry in a sense that continues, obviously through our show as well. Also now through Which Game First, and Celeste being the host of the show just really brings that to life.
I also trained the person who does your post-production, Mike.
Yes.
He sat with me for an entire edit of one of the SGU episodes, and I walked him through everything that I was doing.
He didn't run out screaming?
No.
He didn't?
No, no. He's like, put on his brakes. The funniest thing when he's like, so, you know, I have all the different tracks, and I sort of sync them. And he's like, but they're not exactly synced the way they were in real life. I'm like, no, they're not. It's like, yeah, but they're not the same. I'm like, yeah, it's all fake. Like the alignment of the tracks is all just how it sounds. It doesn't have anything to do with reality. Right. And he had such a hard time wrapping his head around that. It's like, but how do you know, the exact relationship between who said what? It's like, you don't. It doesn't matter. You know, as long as it sounds, I shift people around. Because like sometimes we'll talk over each other. I just separate them. Yeah, whatever it sounds.
But you delete, you mute a bunch of tracks.
I delete everyone who like.
Our raw audio just doesn't go up and that's the show.
Yeah, right. We have one more podcast that we are involved with, and that's Bob, Jay, and I are involved with a science fiction review show called Alpha Quadrant 6.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
You know, this year, 2021, why not pick a few topics that you're interested in, that you don't know much about, or you'd like to sharpen your knowledge on? With The Great Courses, you can learn about thousands of different topics, from how to shoot a camera to Tai Chi to the deepest secrets of science.
I'm really into this course right now called Shocking Psychological Studies and the Lessons They Teach. It's by Thad Polk, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, and it comes with six different lectures that are all fascinating, teaching you about everything from the Tuskegee syphilis experiments to the Belmont Report to the Stanford Prison Experiment to Milgram's Obedience Study and a whole bunch you haven't even heard of. And we learn from this course the outcomes of these studies and how they are challenging our assumptions about ethics and what we should do from here. It's just fascinating. I highly recommend it. Again, one of thousands of courses offered, and you can, of course, stream it in real time. You can save it to watch or listen to later. It's just so flexible to fit your schedule.
What purpose waits for you? Sign up for The Great Courses Plus to find out. Right now, our listeners can get this exclusive offer, a free trial plus $30 off when you sign up for an annual plan. That comes out to just $10 a month. But this limited-time offer won't last long, and it's only available through our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. You don't want to pass this up, so go now to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
I wanted to talk about an interesting news item I came across. So what do you think, George, I'll ask you, what do you think is the carbon footprint of streaming video? Do you think it's significant or insignificant? Let me just say that.
Oh, my gosh. Because when you start considering people are watching in their homes, like what streaming video?
So during the pandemic, obviously, a lot of activity moved online. And right. So if you had to, and you guys, like Bob, Kara, what, if you had to guess if there's an estimate of the increase in the amount of energy being used to run the extra infrastructure for all of the video conferencing we're doing.
All the Zoom calls,
right. All that. What, give me a ballpark. What would you say it is?
But is that counteracted by the fact that no one's going anywhere in terms of using their cars?
Probably, but we're just talking about as an isolated factor.
Okay.
If you just look at the use of video conferencing, how much of, by what percentage is that increase?
I bet it's not that significant.
1,000%.
You're wrong. You're both wrong. It's 20%.
It's smaller than that. I mean, I would say, you know, maybe a 20% increase, which
but
is
every
huge.
School has gone online.
Yeah, but the raw number.
So 96%.
Yeah. So countries have reported like a 20% increase in internet traffic.
Okay.
That's it?
During the pandemic.
Did I just nail it? Did I just nail it?
Yes, you did.
You knew the answer.
You looked at it. So individually, it's obviously insignificant. But in the aggregate, it's a lot of people. You know, you have to multiply it by hundreds of millions of people. And so it actually can be significant. All of that, it's not just the internet traffic. It's using a lot of computing power.
Mm-hmm.
And computing power is significant. It's now becoming a significant proportion of our electricity production.
I mean, the Bitcoin phenomenon
Bitcoin's
alone,
like
that kind of blows things out of the water in a sense.
But even like Bitcoin aside, just everything that we do is using up more computer cycles, which is taking more electricity. And it's a massive percentage of our electricity production now. It's mm-hmm. like we have to consider the carbon footprint of doing things digitally.
Yep.
Because you think, oh, if I don't drive to work and I just, you know, video conference in, that's better. It is. But it does mean that if we could figure out a way to shave efficiency, you know, off of the video conferencing, then that's a huge potential for increasing our greenness, right? Reducing our footprint.
Right,
all right.
Right.
So some people did a study looking at what would we actually save?
Right.
What would we actually save if, let's say, when you join a Zoom call, if you join with video versus without video?
Oh,
right. So turning off your video camera during a Zoom call, that just that piece, how much percentage wise, what does that
80%
say? 80%
savings.
96%.
I was going to say that.
It's such a huge bandwidth difference. Audio only versus
audio only is nothing.
Right. Yeah, audio only.
Video. So remember, the video, they have to compress it. There's a lot of the stuff that goes on. Do you remember back in the 90s when we were doing the early days, when we were desperate to do video conferencing or multiplayer online games? Like, we were early
adopters. TeamSpeak, remember TeamSpeak?
It was terrible.
Oh, gosh.
Video was glitchy and the background was all terrible. Now, like, we just take it for granted. Like, you guys are all watching the streaming and it looks seamless. But that's a massive improvement in the software, like the compression and all the internet protocols. And everything has now been optimized for all this video, which is great. So the quality is huge. But it's not, when you're on Zoom, 96% of your processing power is going to the video.
Absolutely.
And if you just turn the video off, it saves a massive amount.
When I worked in television production a lifetime...
I don't want to turn it off.
When I worked in television production a lifetime ago, one of the leading edge technologies we were working with was streaming services. This was around the year 2000. And we would specialize with a company who would go into hospitals and they would live stream surgeries and other procedures. And so much power and other things had to be dedicated to just get that video signal up and out of that hospital and available for people to watch live. It was a massive undertaking and very expensive as well. And the hospital had to devote certain resources of their electrical department and other departments in order to make sure that that thing flew. This was around the year 2000, 2001.
I had a census computer in my first office. I used to work for Moravian College, the needs department. And I had this like brand new Apple Centris. It was 1994. And I remember downloading a video clip on this internet thing. And it took 4 hours to download this video. It was a 40-second clip of a plane crash at an air show. You know, I like went to lunch. I went to a meeting. I did a bunch of work, came back and watched it. And I was like, this is the most amazing thing in the world. It was so worth it. It was so worth
four
it.
Hours
back then. Back four then, it was like, oh, I just downloaded this. Like, I would never have access. This is amazing. Yeah, but it was like 3.5 hours to download.
That was modem. Whatever
it was. I don't know. Yeah, it wasn't that T1 line for sure, but
and
yeah.
Now how quickly that would be so infuriating.
Oh, I know. If my mouse doesn't click fast enough.
Fly.
It's amazing.
Yeah. You know, Evan, speaking to the TV production work that you were doing, one of my earliest gigs in television was it was a combined job between Nat Geo and I think Mental Floss, and it was called Brain Surgery Live. Mm-hmm. And we were at a hospital in Chicago where live brain surgery was taking place, and we had multiple – it was like – three of us were hosting. There was a waiting room with the family. There was inside the actual operating room. And I had to run back and forth between the family's room, the operating room, and then the other operating room that was central command. We had a bus outside, like this massive kind of trailer outside the hospital. And I want to say the crew, it was out of control. It was like 150 people working on this production just to get this thing, a live brain surgery on television.
Oh, the resources were staggering in some cases. Absolutely.
It was just out of control. Like, it was a behemoth undertaking.
You could do it with a cell phone.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. Let's do it now. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But
there's the surgery.
Is that 96% though? Is that counteracted by the fact that cars aren't driving around as much? Or
yeah, I think
Is there? I don't know.
Yeah. So the carbon footprint of like our country has dropped.
Yeah.
The biggest drop since World War II this year. It's temporary, and they say it's probably going to snap back even worse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a lot of pent up demand that's going to kick in.
I know
in.
Europe was like that too.
But yeah,
like,
absolutely. But going forward, I think a lot of these changes are permanent. I'm going to be permanently doing telehealth now, even though I wasn't before. They also said
it's only going to increase, Steve. Steve, we're going to be throwing around
it's going to
like 4K, 8K video, even 10K video at some point. So the internet's going to be inundated with this video bandwidth, and that's just going to keep going up and up and up. So this is a preview of what we're going to see, I think.
Well, Bob, the video is the other piece to the study where they looked at streaming video, not just like a video conferencing, like you downloading a movie or streaming a movie. So it used to be back in the day, 5 years ago or whatever, where we would have your DVD, then Blu-ray, right? So you would watch your movie locally. There was no streaming involved, no internet involved. Yeah. Now, I can't remember the last time I put in a Blu-ray or a DVD. We stream everything on demand.
Oh, my God.
You all remember what Netflix was,
I know.
Right?
Netflix, they would mail you VHS tapes.
Yes, you would get tapes and discs from Netflix. That was Netflix.
I rented Tenet. Because Tenet wasn't on demand yet, but it was in the red box at the Wegmans. So I got Tenet, and it was like, yeah, I'm like, oh, right. I have a Blu-ray player. All right. Yeah. Cool.
It's already ancient history.
It's amazing.
It's great. It's very convenient, but it's massive bandwidth that we're using now that was not even used before. They also calculated if you stream a movie in high definition versus standard definition, what's the percent decrease?
To go from
decrease in what? Just bandwidth?
In bandwidth. Oh, bandwidth. Internet traffic. Internet traffic.
Reduce it by
86%.
Yeah, I was thinking 86% say 75. Yeah.
So, I mean, I could say turning off my video during. I usually, if I'm not in any way, if I'm just watching a Zoom conference, like I go do my grand rounds, there's 150 people listening to the grand round speaker, I turn my video off. I don't have my video on. They don't need to see me there eating lunch or whatever I'm doing. And although there is pressure, like they've said, hey, let's, everyone have your video on so he's not talking to an empty room. It's like, I'm not doing that.
No.
But it's also not a good idea.
No, it's not a good idea.
It's not, and I'll send this article to my chairman and say, we really shouldn't be encouraging everybody to have their video running when you're just watching.
Yeah.
Like you are, turn it on when you ask a question. Yes, turn it on when you ask, but then turn it off when you're just watching. Yeah.
Steve, just an aside, somebody mentioned that in the chat that, can we see the difference between 8K and 10K? And the reason I threw in 10K is because I remember reading that if you had to compare human vision to that standard, the 4K, 8K, this article said that human vision is approximately 10K.
So, yeah. All right, Bob, why don't you tell us about solar gravitational lenses?
So researchers have a plan and have gotten almost unprecedented support from NASA to create a space-borne observatory to directly image the surface of exoplanets using solar gravitational lensing to see high-resolution images of continents and oceans of this exoplanet many, many light years away within our lifetimes. If you know about imaging and exoplanets, that's not incremental. That's truly a gargantuan quantum leap. And I don't like that term quantum leap because, in quantum mechanics, whatever, I won't even get into that. But exoplanets, I think, is one of the most important, advances that we've had in the past decade. Steve, I'm sure you would agree. It's a huge success story. For the past decade, we've had over 4,300 confirmed exoplanets discovered and thousands more that probably will be confirmed very soon. They've already been detected. So it's an amazing success story. And I think you'd be surprised how many methods there are to detect exoplanets. There's at least a couple dozen of them, but there's only really two major methods that have done the bulk of them. Of those 4,300, 93% have been detected through the transit method, right? Where the planet eclipses part of the star and the light dims. And then there's the radial velocity method, which causes a wobble in the star, the gravitational pull. So those are the two main methods, but they're a little bit unsatisfying, because we're basically inferring the existence of these exoplanets. And they're confirmed for sure, but it's kind of an inference, and there's nothing like directly seeing the light that's coming from an exoplanet, right? And that's exactly what direct imaging is, seeing that light that's either reflected from the planet off of its parent star or infrared light that's actually generated by the planet or also reflected as well. Now, we've actually directly imaged a bunch of exoplanets, but only about 50. So it's just a small pittance of exoplanets. It's very, very difficult. And what we have seen is basically gas giants that are really, really far from their star. The holy grail of exoplanets would be what? It would have to be a direct image of an Earth-sized exoplanet, right? That would be the ultimate if we could actually see that planet. So is there anything in the future that's going to do this? So we got the James Webb telescope that's coming out in 2021, this year, that's going to be able to directly image a planet, but it's going to be just a spot. It's just going to be, we're going to be able to see the brightness changes of the planet and maybe some rotation, but it's really going to be just a spot. We've got another telescope, the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope in 2025, and that will see atmospheric spectra by direct imaging, but even that's just the spectra. That's just the chemistry of the atmosphere. It's not going to be able to see any real details. And then if we go out to 2035, 14 years from now, there's a plan to have HABEX, which is a habitable exoplanet observatory. It's in a concept phase now, but even that one with its 4-meter primary mirror
will only be able to look at the atmospheric chemistry. It's not going to look at the surface. Now, a four meter primary mirror is pretty good. I mean, that's a decent size, but using that kind of technology, using a lens, using even segmented mirrors, they have a practical limit that they'll never be able to get some very, very high resolution of these very distant exoplanets. So the answer then is what we said in the beginning here, solar gravitational lensing. That is what could take us not just one step or an order of magnitude closer, but many orders of magnitude closer to seeing the detail of an exoplanet 100 light years away that you would not probably believe is possible. So the idea is to use the immense gravity of our sun to bend the light and focus it, and then going to that focus point, that focal point, and observing it. So the idea, so the light would be focused from the sun. And when you get to that point from the sun and you look at the sun, you will see an Einstein ring, which is the image of that distant exoplanet. If you remove that, if you look at that image, that Einstein ring, and you remove the distortion, you could magnify that exoplanet by 100 billion times, 100 billion times, with an angular resolution that's mind-boggling. It's 10 to the minus 10 arc seconds, or 0.1 nano arc seconds. That's basically seeing the width of a hair on the moon from the Earth. That's the angular resolution is amazing. But that number, 100 billion times magnification, is just mind-boggling. This is far beyond anything that we have that we are even contemplating at this point. You know, look at the Habex. That's 14 years in the future, and it's not even close to what this could potentially do. And researchers say that this is doable within decades, not within 100 years or 200 years, within decades. They claim that their simulations show that they could create a 1,000 by 1,000 image, a million pixel image of an exoplanet that is 100 light years away. And that would show everything that I've mentioned. It would show continents. It would show the oceans and vegetation, desert. It will show it could show lights on the dark side of the planet. I mean, this could be potentially evidence of life on other planets. If we see lights going on and off on the dark side of a planet, or if we see vegetation, I think you could be pretty confident that there's life on that planet. Now, if you could create a telescope, a conventional telescope to duplicate this, it would have to be 90,000 kilometers in diameter, seven times Earth's, 90,000 kilometers. That's not going to happen. I don't care what kind of, even in 200 years, if we could build a micron thick telescope in space, it would weigh over 1 trillion kilograms. The tidal forces of the Earth would destroy it. And if it was out in space, say at a Lagrange point, the solar wind from the sun would just blow it out of the solar system. So that's really not going to happen, even if you posit something as so amazing as a 90,000 kilometer diameter telescope in space. This is something that we could potentially do very, very soon. So, of course, the devil's in the details, and the details are fascinating and daunting. That it's not a focal point. It's a focal line. And so you could actually cruise along that focal line and take images of that Einstein ring, of that distorted image of the exoplanet. And that's great, because you have a long time. You have, you know, you could have potentially billions of miles or even light years where you could still image that planet. It's not a point where you've got to travel there and then stop in relationship to the sun, which would be very difficult, right, in terms of rocket fuel. So that's the good news. The bad news is where that focal line starts. It's very, very far from the sun. The sun's got a huge gravitational pull, but it's not that big in terms of where that focus is going to be. The focus that we would have to go to, the focal line, we would have to go 650 AUs from the sun.
That's far.
That's a lot. That's four times Voyager 1's distance. You know, the Voyager 1 probe, it's the most distant object we've ever launched in space. It's four times that. 60 billion miles. 97 billion kilometers. That's really, really far. We could get there, though, in 20 to 30 years. They've got some solid plans to make that happen. 650 AU. Now, an AU is an astronomical unit. It's a distance from the Earth to the sun, 93 million miles. So it's really, really far. So imagine you travel out from the sun, you turn around, and you're looking at the sun and you see the Einstein ring. Now, of course, you're going to need something like a coronagraph to block out the sun because the sun is going to be very, very bright. So you're blocking that out. You see this ring. That ring at that distance will be really big in terms of absolute diameter or width. That's 1.3 kilometers wide. That's a lot. You would need a 1.3 kilometer mirror to see the whole thing. That's not going to happen. But you can take a 1 meter mirror, and that 1 meter mirror that would then image the Einstein ring one pixel at a time. Every image is a pixel. Then the probe would move, and they would take another pixel image. And it could do, you know, it could take months. But after months, it would build up this rasterized image of that exoplanet. Now, it would also have to, they'd have to run some deconvolution algorithms. These are algorithms that they've developed for the sun, specifically for the sun, so that it dewarps it and it unblurs it because it's very distorted. But using these algorithms, they'd run simulations that show that they can do this. They can create this image. You know, we potentially could have this happen within most of our lifetimes. That is an amazing feat because right now we're seeing dots. Here you're seeing a million pixel image that we could potentially create using this method that these scientists or these researchers have created. Now getting there will be difficult, but if we had nuclear thermal rockets, we could get there in 10 years. But we don't have those. Hopefully we will in the near future, and maybe we will use those. But there's also proposals using solar sails. They call it a solar vane. There's estimates using the SLS rockets to do it. So they could get there in 20 to 30 years using that technology. You don't have to look just at exoplanets with this technology. You could do things like you could image the surface of stars in other galaxies using this idea. Imagine that, not just within our galaxy, potentially Andromeda. You could scope out the surface of stars in Andromeda potentially. You could get a high resolution image of the very first galaxy as they formed, 11, 12, 13 billion years ago. You could actually map the event horizons of black holes using solar gravitational lenses. You could create, an Encyclopedia Galactica, as Sagan called it, of exoplanets, and with details that would make researchers just lose their shit today. Now, a lot of this technology, it may sound like science fiction, but some of this technology is here already, or it's being worked on. It's actively being worked on. It's not like something that, maybe somebody will start working on this in 10, 20, 30 years. They're actually working on stuff like this now. And one of the good things that happened in 2020 was that NASA awarded these researchers $2 million for a phase 3 study of this. That's only the third time NASA has ever done that. They don't throw around their money that freely. But for NIAC, they've only done this 3 times. And what a phase 3 means is that you're transitioning from a study to an actual mission proposal. So hopefully this year they will actually have that mission proposal, and then NASA will vet it and then hopefully decide that this is doable and worthy. I think it's definitely worthy for sure. They think, the researchers think, now these are theoretical physicists, Victor Toth and Slava G. Tereshev, there is a physicist at NASA JPL. They think that we could be ready by the end of the decade. So 9 years, they think this could be ready. And we could see the first high resolution image of an exoplanet within 35 years. So, a lot of us here would be able to see that. And I think it would be one of the great discoveries or scientific achievements of all time. It's an amazing possibility that I didn't think we'd be able to do within any of our lifetimes. And this is the best way, and probably one of the only ways, we can get such resolution in the next 100 years or 200 years. This might be the only real way to do it, unless you want to travel to the center of our galaxy and use a black hole as a gravitational lens. That would be nice too, but that's a little bit far away. All right, that's all
so
I got.
35 Woo! Years. That's a long time.
It is, but within most of our...
Our younger listeners may really, but that's also probably optimistic.
It's probably optimistic, but you know how these things go. But just the idea that this is possible, this technology is within our grasp. It's not like artificial intelligence was, a half a century ago, 60 years ago. This is like, within a decade, we could be ready to launch this stuff. And sure, then we got to wait 20 to 30 years for the actual travel time. But hey, if we had nuclear thermal engines, we could do it in 10 years. 10 years we could be there.
Yeah, but we're 20 years away from nuclear thermal engines.
Well, Steve, they're working on nuclear thermal engines right now.
Yeah, right now means 20 or 30 years from now we'll have them flying. Something like that. Might be longer. All right. So, Kara.
Yes.
You want to talk about the assassin bug?
Scientists have recently found a fossil. And what is so great about this fossil? You can see it's junk. Yeah, no, really, that's
fossils. Love it.
Yeah, that's this story. Okay, so this is a 50 million year old insect. It's not an assassin bug, but it comes from the assassin bug lineage, and it actually represents a new genus and species of these predatory insects. I'm gonna try and read the Latin name once and then I will not attempt again. It's Aphelicophantes danjudi, and it's pretty stunning. What was so cool about this particular specimen is that it happened to kind of slice itself in half upon fossilization. And because of the way that it was sliced, there it is, you know, down between its legs, its genitalia. And this is pretty cool. So oftentimes we're not able to see insect genitalia in paleontological specimens and fossilized specimens. And that's, of course, because they're on the inside of the body most often. So here's a quote from Dan Swanson, who's a graduate student in entomology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the co-author of the paper that described these findings. He said, insect genitalia are only extremely rarely preserved in the fossil record. Structures of the internal genitalia are very small, and the forces of pressure and time that are required to produce a fossil are not kind to these delicate structures. But actually, in the Green River Formation in northwestern Colorado, which is between 53.5 and 48.5 million years old, this insect likely fell into one of the lakes that covered this region, sunk into the kind of dirty, mucky bottom that allowed sediment and debris to pile up on top of the insect carcass. And in doing it slowly over time, it was able to fossilize and keep all of these really delicate structures in place. And some of the cues as to why this is very likely an assassin bug is because of the banding on its legs and the absence of its, the absence of body spines. And if we were to talk about assassin bugs as they exist today, extant assassin bugs, they are found in temperate and tropical regions around the globe. There are about 7,000 species of them. Another 50 species have been identified from fossils, and they're called the assassin bug because they have a beak and they jab it into their prey, usually other arthropods. They pump digestive juices in through that beak, and then they suck out the resulting soup, according to Swanson.
It's called soup.
So yeah, they suck out, because what they do is they basically put these digestive juices into the other insects or into the other arthropods. It breaks down their tissues, and then they slurp all that yumminess right back out. Cool. So not only is this just a really cool bug or insect, because this this bad boy is an assassin bug, which is cool in and of itself, but also how fun that the actual genitalia were well preserved. And it turns out, interestingly, that even in this 50 million year old insect, the genitalia are quite similar to the reproductive organs that we see in extant assassin bugs.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing how much stability there is over evolutionary time. But it's always like, it's never the species that are around today. Like somebody said, oh, we found a living coelacanth. It's like, yeah, we found a living member of, I think it's the family, right? The coelacanth family. It's not the same
species. Probably, yeah, it's probably not even a genus.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not anywhere. It's not,
and I can look
know,
it up.
That's like saying we found, you know, a primate. Yeah. There are still primates around. They're not the same primates that were around millions of years ago, but they're in the same family.
Yeah, they
the primates in order? Yeah, primates in order.
Yeah, well, actually, coelacanthiforms is an order also.
Yes. Oh, it's an order level. Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's a really high classification order. George, why don't you do the stealing monkey bit?
Oh, sure. So in a Balinese temple, there are these monkeys that over time have learned to steal items from people that are visiting the temple. which is like, oh, okay, you figure that out. And what they end up doing is they sort of ransom. They ransom these items. So they steal something.
Trade.
They trade, yeah. So they steal your sunglasses. They'll run up to you and it's like, oh, look, cute monkey. They grab your sunglasses and they won't give it back. Unless you give them food. Mostly it's food.
They've learned to steal stuff and trade it for food.
So they've learned, hey, take something from the people that are visiting the deal and they'll give you food for it. The thing is, they've been doing this for about 30 years. There's something like five generations of these capuchin monkeys, I guess they are. They have actually learned what items humans value more.
Whoa.
And they have learned that cell phones, prescription glasses, and handbags are the most valuable items to steal. So they will steal those and they will not take first, second, third, and fourth offers of bribes. So like if you lose a baseball hat, most people like don't care about that. So they whatever. So they've actually learned how to steal these things and they teach each other like what you want to take. Not that they're speaking, but in essence, it's like what's most valuable is shiny, small, metallic things in the human's hands. Those things on their faces. Cause they're going to want, not the dark ones. The dark ones they don't care about. The ones that are clear.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like in essence, they're figuring out the things that are of more value. They said one of the longest barters that, and these researchers have been filming this, and one of the longest barter things that they saw took like 25 minutes, where they kept coming. The monkey would grab the glasses and run away. And so you get whatever, you get a bag of peanuts or whatever the hell's going on. Monkey comes back and is like, nope. Monkey walks away. Mm-hmm. So then you go and get two bags of peanuts. Monkey comes back. It's like, nope. Monkey goes away. So you get two bags of peanuts and a piece of cake. It's like monkey goes back. Nope. 26 minutes was the longest.
They've learned the value of the things that they've stolen.
They've learned the value. But they know you won't do that if it's a flip-flop or if it's a shopping bag. But if it's a cell phone, if it's your glasses, if it's a wallet.
They understand leverage.
But George, so what's the story? The story is they go back, they go away, right? And these guys, you know, other monkeys there, hey, how's it going? And they offered me a bag of peanuts. I'm not taking it.
What are you going to do?
I don't know what I'm going to take for that. What do you got? It's the glasses. Oh, that's at least five bags of peanuts glasses, you got
is
there.
Is it bifocal? What do you got there?
It's bifocal. That's seven
bags of peanuts. Easy. If you go back there for less than seven, you're the chump.
That's why the monkey comes back, guy's got two bags, he's like, no.
No. Do I look stupid to you?
I love that.
Can't do it.
Is that not insane?
That's awesome.
And what's next? They're going to be like stealing cars at some point.
Yeah. That is awesome. Mm.
Then they'll be doing bitcoins before you know it.
Like children.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, KiwiCo.
Yeah, KiwiCo creates these really cool hands-on projects that are designed to expose kids of all ages to concepts in science, technology, engineering, art, and math. So the mission here is to help kids build confidence and creativity, critical thinking skills, of course, and have one of those moments where they're like, wow, this is really cool. You know, like building something that they never thought they can build or do something that they never thought they can do.
And what I love is that there are so many different options to choose from. There are lines all the way from the Panda Crate, which is 0 to 24 months of age, to the Maker Crate and the Eureka Crate, which are ages 14 to 104. I've got to tell you, I fit in that category and I am obsessed with the Maker Crate. It's so cool. We're talking techniques and projects across all sorts of arts and crafts themes like paper marbling, metal sculpture, dip dye painting, macrame, learning how to knit on a loom, how to hand letter and do embroidery, and so, so, so much more.
With KiwiCo's hands-on art and science projects, kids can engineer a walking robot, design a paint pendulum, conduct bubbling chemistry experiments, and more, all from the comfort of home. Everything you need to make science, technology, engineering, art, and math seriously fun, delivered to your doorstep. Get 30% off your first month plus free shipping on any crate line with code SKEPTICS. That's 30% off your first month at KIWICO.com, promo code SKEPTICS.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, we're going to introduce a new segment here that we developed for the 12-hour live stream. This segment is simply called Is It True?, where one of the rogues puts forward a fact that may or may not be true, and then you have to figure that out. Carrie, you're going to go first.
Is it true? The average Egyptian pyramid builder's lifespan was 40 to 45 years. So again, is it true? The average Egyptian pyramid builder's lifespan was 40 to 45 years. I'm seeing true, 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 false, true, false, true. Some people saying probably much shorter than that. A lot of trues here. What do you guys think?
I mean, my initial reaction is that's about right for that time period, but it could be shorter. It could have been that.
False.
It could have been that it was shorter than that.
It was longer. I think they were actually well taken care of. Well,
but
fed,
a well taken care of person, life expectancy or lifespan? Those are two different things.
I said the word lifespan.
Lifespan. 70, 80, no problem.
Yeah, lifespan could
so
be.
So they caught on.
So that's true.
You guys caught on to the trick here.
70, yeah, life expectancy might have been younger, but lifespan was 70 years at that time, something like that.
Yeah,
right, life expectancy is because of the very high birth rate death.
Pardon
birth
me,
rate death?
I mean the death of infants.
Right. So something that's really important for us to make a distinction between is life expectancy and lifespan. And you see this misstated and misquoted all the time in headlines. So this is cause to be really skeptical. Yes, Bob, we all see your Flamin' Hot Cheetos.
They will melt your face.
So keep in mind that when we talk about life expectancy, that's a cumulative statistic that's based on averaging together all the people who died averaging together all the people who lived and died during that era. And so the number plummets because of infant mortality. And there's actually a stepwise shift. So a ton of people died at birth. A lot of people died around the age of 5. A lot fewer people died around the age of 12. And you have, it's like once you hit about 15, and then again, once you hit 25, your lifespan was expected to be much longer. So you had to get through these critical periods of the lifespan where many people happened to die because of infectious diseases of childhood or because of obviously problems during childbirth. So the life expectancy of an individual who lived in ancient Egypt at this era, the era of the pyramids, was 40 to 45 years. And that was for men. But the lifespan was, guys, it's not that different than it is now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I read that.
Lifespan is almost the same. And so Socrates was 70 or 80 years old when he died. And that's, yes, somewhat anomalous in the sense that he was able to live that long, but the span, there's nothing inherent about the fact that we aged younger back then. And I think that's a huge misunderstanding. People think that if you live to be 35, it's you were a ripe old man but at 35 during Jesus's era. No, it's just that people died of disease younger. That's all.
Cara, we have Neanderthal skeletons that died when they were probably 70. They looked like really old. So we know that people were surviving into old age, even, you know, millions of years ago. But you're right. The lifespan.
And they didn't have any special gift. They didn't have badass biology. The issue is they didn't succumb to illness that would have killed them.
It's just luck. Someone's going to get lucky enough.
Yeah, they were lucky. But the lifespan itself hasn't really changed since prehistory. So anytime you hear somebody, think about the phrasing, the average lifespan was probably 70 or 80. The average life expectancy was around 45. But of course, that is also a statistical anomaly. Because since I said the average lifespan of the average pyramid builder's lifespan, that also includes or, I guess, presupposes that those people were old enough to be building pyramids.
Mm-hmm. They've already survived their childhood. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
They got through the filter already.
Exactly. So keep that in mind. That's a tricky one, but you'll see it a lot.
I've got one with you in mind, Kara.
Okay. What do we got?
Is it true? Ready? Mm-hmm. Dogs can't look up.
According to not Simon Pegg, but who's his friend?
Sean and Ed. Yeah, that was
Ed. Ed's the one who says dogs can't look up, not Sean.
Right. That's right. Sean says.
The loaded gun at the Winchester, was actually loaded. So I'm going to say dogs can look up. I'm going to say that's false.
Can dogs look up, Steve? Have you heard of that?
I've never heard that one. It sounds ridiculous.
My dog looks up at me all the time.
It is ridiculous, and it did come from the movie Shaun of the Dead. That's where it originated.
Yeah.
You know, back and forth funny thing between two characters who were arguing this point. But it's actually quite often searched, that question, as a result. So the Google hits on it are apparently, you know, relatively significant enough that it has become sort of a thing, a myth, in its own right. Bob, can dogs look up?
I'd say, yeah. Absolutely. I've owned little dogs for decades. They look up to me very much.
Dogs can look up, yes.
Experts estimate that on average people swallow 8 spiders a year while they sleep. True or false?
Baloney.
8 spiders?
Yeah.
False. Doesn't sound
true.
Right.
I say false.
Why would?
It's probably false, but it could be true.
Yeah.
It's completely false.
Yeah.
So the answer is probably close to zero. You know, spiders have absolutely no reason to crawl into your open mouth while you're sleeping.
Yeah, it's not like they're looking for a heat source to bundle up.
Exactly. That's a dangerous, wet, noisy place. Why would they crawl in there? Also, think about how would you gather that data?
I just saw that in the stream. Somebody's like, how would you even measure that?
I mean, you would have to do sleep studies, I guess. We do sleep studies where we videotape people sleeping all night. We'd have to estimate it from that. That would be a data source, I suppose. But it's just not true. Like, it's never been observed happening. And spider experts say, no, why would – spiders don't do that. Why would – because that's death, right?
They're not. How did that even become a thing? How did that become a –
You know, it's not clear.
It's a common myth, though, right, Steve? Things like you swallow so many bugs in a year, there's so many rats in you know, whatever, or there's so many cockroaches and coffee beans.
2 pounds of undigested chewing gum in your lower intestine.
Yeah, well, that's nonsense.
Yeah, that one definitely. But just bugs where they shouldn't be, I feel like, is a very common myth that we hear.
Yeah, but it's also some reality to it as well, because, like, when you have, like, food manufacturing – there is a certain amount of flies that are going to get in the ointment.
Yeah, they tolerate.
Yeah, there are tolerable levels of contamination. Apparently, there's a mole count for tomatoes.
So many flies legs per parts per million is allowed.
You can have rats.
A certain amount. I actually, when I was doing research for Is It True, one of the things that I found was true is that from time to time, you'll see that entomologists find themselves allergic to coffee. For that same reason, because ground coffee very often will have just a certain number of, like, cockroaches ground up in it, because, you know, they're interested in the coffee beans. And so when they grind the coffee, every so often there's a certain, you know, that allowable amount of cockroaches, and you'll actually see that entomologists will develop allergies to it. And that was an Is It True when I was doing my research.
Our drinking water isn't even pure. If it were, it would be dangerous, so... There's all sorts of stuff in drinking water.
Yeah. You can't drink ultra pure water. No, that's for sure.
No, you can't do that.
What do you think about this one? John Wilkes Booth's brother, Edwin Booth, saved the life of Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln.
Yes, Robbie's alive, so I'll say true.
You guys think that him Lincoln's son?
Yeah, I'm going to say that's false.
And the the Booths, I think, didn't live far
from Washington. It's true.
They lived right outside Washington.
It's true. It is true. He saved him on a train platform from falling onto the tracks. Wow. Yeah. And it happened not long before, I think, the brother killed the father.
Oh, I've got one.
All right, go.
Go ahead, George.
Magellan was the first person to circumnavigate the world.
So that's what we're told, right?
I'm going to say no.
But there were other explorers. Yeah. You should think that it's true, which makes me think that maybe it's not true.
It's universally accepted. And if you look it up, it says Magellan was the first. But he died halfway around the trip.
So he got only halfway.
He died in the Philippines. The excursion of his.
His excursion was.
His excursion finished. But the second in command, Juan Sebastian del Carno, he's officially the first person to circumnavigate because he was on the entire trip. But no one remembers... Like, I have to read it. Juan Sebastian del Carno. Because he got to the Philippines and he died.
So he got halfway. So who did? who was on that ship?
Juan Sebastian de Carlo, the second in command, is the person that's considered
to
have
rename
finished.
That GPS company after that.
He finished and.
Okay, I got one.
Pineapple takes about 2 years to grow.
True.
Yeah.
No, it's absolutely true.
A pineapple takes about 2 years to grow.
It goes through two holes.
I'll say it's true.
2 years? That seems too long.
It's true.
Fake. Growing pineapples from tops of shop-bought pineapples can take up to 24 months and even longer in colder climates. Suckers, which I think is
the people who buy them?
Yeah. Suckers take 18 months and... So 18 months. So 2 years, 18 months to 2 years for a pineapple to grow.
Well, that makes sense. When Carol?
That's a time investment, boy.
I do love pineapple. My favorite fruit.
All right. There are animals whose fingerprints are indistinguishable from human fingerprints, even by crime scene analysts.
I think it's like koalas or something.
I think koalas, yeah.
I think it's like koalas or...
It's koalas! Kind of... You're right.
Is that indistinguishable?
Indistinguishable even under like high powered microscopes, the ridges, you cannot tell the difference between human fingerprints. And only koalas, that's the animal.
Bob, you have one?
Yeah. The Fisher Space Pen was not commissioned by NASA at a cost of millions of dollars.
That's correct that it was not.
That's correct. That's a really common myth. They said, oh, we're so stupid that we spent millions of dollars for a space pen, a pen that would write in space, and the Soviets used pencils. So, but actually, this was independently developed by the Paul C. Fisher. He's the founder of the Fisher Pen Company, and he spent $1 million of his own money to develop it. Then NASA tested it and approved the pen for space and purchased 400 of them for $6 a pen. Very reasonable, I guess. The Soviet Union subsequently also purchased a space pen for its Soyuz space flight. So,
you know why?
Because the pencils were, the shavings were clogging stuff. You couldn't use it.
Right. Pencils are bad in space in zero G.
Because
they break off. You have to sharpen it. You know, what are you going to do?
It gets into the hoo-haws and stuff.
It's not good. So that's the, yeah.
The hoo-haws, huh? The hoo-haws. I don't think the pencils were going there.
Yeah. I mean, believe me. It's lonely up there. Come on. It's cold and lonely. I got a killer one.
Go ahead.
We'll keep going around.
Oh, go good.
Yeah.
Babe Ruth was one of the greatest pitchers in in baseball history.
Oh, yes.
I mean, for his time, or
he still has records. He still has a record.
He would be considered one of the greatest pitchers of all.
I would believe that.
What?
The guy was insanely talented.
Babe Ruth,
man,
record 94 wins, 46 losses, 11th best all time, lifetime earned run average 2.28. 16th best among all players, but 11th best in the modern era. Gave up only 10 home runs and 1,200 innings pitched. Pitched 9 shutouts in 1916, which was a record until 1978.
Wow.
5-0 with the Yankees. He wasn't even a pitcher, and he came in and spotted them. Best ERA in baseball in 1916. Pitched 29 scoreless World Series innings. That record stood for 42 years, and he was undefeated in the World Series as a pitcher with less than one ERA. Those would get him in the Hall of Fame as a pitcher.
That's amazing.
Yep.
That guy was baseball,
the greatest baseball player of all time.
And he had the worst swing in the world.
No doubt about it.
All right. Police will not accept a missing person report for 24 hours.
No.
I don't think that's true.
That's a movie thing. Baloney.
But George, I heard that on television.
I know.
That is the most. I hear that so often.
It's so, it's totally in the
It is a completely TV mythology.
And if he's a cop, he has to tell you.
And that's also bullshit. So it's so embedded, though, in the culture, the screenwriting culture. It's amazing. It's zero reality to it. Police are like, my 2-year-old son's missing. Well, yeah, call us back in 24 hours. Come on, it's ridiculous.
when you apply any brain, to
I know
it,
when
you're
you
like,
think
no
about
way.
It.
Yeah. My baby in her stroller is missing. I'll come back tomorrow.
You come back tomorrow. Yeah.
I don't make the rules, lady. I just watch TV.
All right. Is this true? China used more cement in 3 years between 2011 and 2013 than the United States did in the entire 20th century.
Yes, because of the dam.
And all not even the dam.
The
Yangtze
Dam.
The infrastructure is insane there.
Yeah. I mean,
I think so.
Yes,
That's true.
Wow.
It's true.
Wow.
I've heard something
nuts.
Like that.
All right. So
mind-blowing.
Think about this. The entire 20th century that the U.S. manufactured and used cement, and they did it in 2 years.
Yeah.
2 years.
Wow.
I'm not surprised.
That's incredible.
It's incredible.
I told you. when I visited Dongguan, the people there were like, this was a farming community, like not that long ago, like, you know, 10 years ago. And when I went, it had 30 million people in it. Oh, and that's like a small million. City.
Yeah.
China's.
It's bananas.
Yeah. It's a different.
It's just cranes as far as the eye can see building skyscrapers in China.
Yeah. And they're just, a lot of them are empty. They're just like, entire cities are just empty because they've just built this yeah. thing. And like,
no yeah. They're just building, building, building. But they know that the population's blowing up.
Cities of New York. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Imagine where they're going to be in 50 years. It's amazing what they're accomplishing. What they're making some really smart investments. Just like they got so much more of a long view than we do. It's ridiculous. Mm. I mean, it's just a matter of time before they are number one.
Except with carbon emissions,
and a lot more than they're already number one in.
So this is a question kind of thingy. How many poles are there at the ends of the Earth?
Oh, there's like six.
Yeah. There's lots.
There's three different types, I think.
Yeah, there's different types of poles.
Are you talking like
geographical? There's magnetic. Real
magnetic,
poles?
Geographic,
at
and
least
then the
six that I could think of.
You're saying six?
At least
I think six.
I could think of.
12 poles.
12?
Might be more. Honestly, it's going to be in
my
pairs.
Brain is so fried. I'm not even sure what we're talking about.
Kara said what? It's going to be what, Kara?
I said it's definitely going to be in pairs, and I think it's six, but it could be eight or 10 or 12.
Is it in pairs, Kara?
A rare tripod.
That's what a pole is.
Is it in pairs? It's actually 11.
So we have a unipole?
Here we go. We've got the geographic pole.
Yes.
Yep. We've got the geomagnetic pole.
Yeah, that's two.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
You've got the magnetic pole.
Yeah.
They're different. You've got the celestial pole.
The celestial, that's where angels come from.
Right? Okay, yeah.
You have the poles of inaccessibility.
You can't go to them.
Which is the farthest from any water point. And number 11 is the ceremonial south pole, which is just
It's used
for photos. It's used for all. It's the official ceremonial south pole.
But it's not really
the south pole. It's a couple.
No, but I think I told you guys, my friend who wintered over in Odmundson at the research station in the south pole, when they joined the 300 club. Did I tell you guys about the 300 club? Where they strip naked, and it can only happen certain days of the year because it's the coldest days of the year. They strip naked, run outside, touch the geographic south pole, run back inside and get in the hot tub, and their body span 300 degrees within only a few minutes. And there's only there's only a few people on the planet who have ever done that.
Wait, what do you mean?
Touching the ceremonial pole.
They're 300 degrees.
Is it more than that? Is it the 400 club? Well, it's going from the hot tub.
I think it's less.
No, it's going from the hot tub to the outdoors with no clothes on in the geographic South Pole in the coldest time of the year. That's 300 degrees.
Let's say it's 100. Let's say the hot tub's 100.
Hot tubs aren't 100 degrees. Are they?
Fahrenheit?
Maybe they're 105. Yeah, I guess they're 105.
Yeah, definitely.
So is it negative 200?
So it's not negative 200 Fahrenheit.
Oh, is it negative 100? Is it the 200 club? It might be the 200
club. That's more reasonable.
Whatever it is, only a handful of people like on the globe.
Oh, my God. That's
cool. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I have one for you guys. The Holy Roman Empire still existed when the U.S. was founded.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it went to the 1800s.
Yeah, but don't confuse that with the Roman Empire. It's two very different things.
The Holy Roman Empire was neither Holy Roman nor an Empire.
Discuss.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
the answer was funny.
Is yes.
So when did the Holy Roman Empire dissolve?
Well, the early 1900s?
Mm. No. God, not that late.
1800s, right?
I mean 1800s?
It was only 1806 when Francis II abdicated the throne. But of course, the Second Continental Congress met in 1776. So it's 30 years later that the Holy Roman Empire dissolved. Ayo!
The Continental Congress met. That was just when the Declaration of Independence was signed.
Right.
At the Second Continental.
But that's like officially when the United States was formed.
Okay, all right. No, is that...
Wait a second, Kara. So it's not a hot tub; it's a sauna. So that would explain.
It's hotter. Okay,
really hot sauna.
Good call.
Okay, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
So every week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. There's a theme for this science or fiction number one. The theme is ancient civilizations.
Okay? Yes.
Ancient civilizations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ancient civ. Took courses in it.
So, item number one. The Yamato Dynasty of Japan is the longest surviving dynasty, spanning 2,680 years from 660 BCE to the present day. Item number two, the Indus Valley Civilization, stretching from 3,300 to 1,900 BCE in the region of Pakistan and India, had advanced urban design. Its largest city, Harappa, housed almost 1 million inhabitants. And item number three, Mesopotamia, generally considered to be the oldest human civilization, is credited with the development of the wheel, measuring time, written language, mathematics, the map, and agriculture. All right, let's start in the studio. We'll go from left to right, starting with you, Evan. Which one of these do you think is the fiction?
Okay, well, I'll jump right to it. I have a feeling that the Yamato Dynasty of Japan is the fiction. The Mesopotamian one, I think I have the most confidence in that all of that is correct. The one I have less confidence in is the Indus Valley Civilization. I really don't know much about that region, not nearly to the extent I probably should. But I don't think the Japan dynasty is that long. I mean, I might be confusing it with the Chinese dynasty, which I'm also thinking is shorter than that, but I have a feeling it's Japan.
All right, Jay?
Yeah, I wouldn't remember the name of the Japanese dynasty, but I do believe that they have had an incredibly ancient dynasty, so I think that one is science. Mesopotamia, if I'm remembering correctly, I absolutely agree that they did all those things, that all of that stuff was achieved there. So I think the second one is the fiction, and I think it is more than a million inhabitants.
Okay. George?
The only thing throwing me is, I don't know if it's a technicality, if Mesopotamia is considered the generation, is considered the dynasty, as opposed to the location of a dynasty. But I'm gonna agree with Evan. I think that number one is the fiction. Although, yeah, I'm gonna
say Yamato dynasty.
The Yamato is not that. Yes.
Okay, Bob.
Wow. Yeah, I just have no real confidence levels. But I think the Yamato dynasty, I think there's something wrong with that. I don't think it's quite that long. Or are they still considered to survive to present day? For whatever reason, I'll call that fiction.
And Kara?
Let me just get a quick summary of everyone. So we've got Bob, Jay, and Evan. Or no, Bob, George and Evan. Yeah. Thinks Yamato's the fiction, right?
Correct.
No, Jay thinks the Indus Valley is
yes.
the fiction.
Yeah, thank you.
The everyone
Indus
believes
Valley civilization.
Mesopotamia so far.
3,300 to 1,900 BCE in the largest region of, its largest city, Harappa, housed almost 100. Do you mean over that span of time or do you mean at any given time?
No, yeah. At one point in time, there was a million people living in that city.
There's no way. That long ago, we didn't have that many people. I don't even think we had a million inhabitants on the planet. I could be wrong, but I think that there were only a billion people on the planet like a couple hundred years ago. The okay. numbers are mind-boggling. So I feel like that one's probably the fiction.
Even 1900 BCE is too distant to have that?
I think so. I could be wrong, but I'm going to go with Jay and say that a million people is way too high.
All right, so you guys are divided between the first and the second one, so we'll start with number three. Mesopotamia, generally considered to be the oldest human civilization, is credited with the development of the wheel, measuring time, written language, mathematics, the map, and agriculture. You all think that one is science. And only one of those has to be wrong in order for this to be the fiction.
That's right.
But this one is science.
That's impressive. That's amazing.
I thought you guys might balk a little bit at the long listing. But yeah, they like you think of things like the map. They developed something so basic and fundamental as the map. You know, it's amazing.
I thought the map was invented in Minecraft.
The idea of writing stuff down, of adding numbers. I mean, the wheel, you know, measuring time.
Yeah,
like measuring,
yeah,
marking.
That's
time
impressive.
That's like all the basic nuts and bolts of civilization are credited.
Did they invent breathing as well?
Sight.
I guess we'll work our way backwards. Number two, the Indus Valley Civilization, stretching from 3,300 to 1,900 BCE in the region of Pakistan and India, had advanced urban design. Its largest city, Harappa, housed almost 1 million inhabitants. Jay and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
This is the fiction. Nice. Now, everything in that is true except for the 1 million.
Ah,
up or down.
Well,
up or down.
All the gear, nice.
It's much lower, right? It's not 100, higher.
Hang on. So in the Indus Valley civilization, this is one thing, like a lot of people don't even know this existed, but this is a major ancient civilization. You know, it was huge. They did have the most advanced urban design of the time, and their largest city was Harappa. Now, the entire civilization, Kara, probably had between 3 and 6 million inhabitants at any given time at its peak. So, yes, there were millions of humans on the planet at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But in one city, they had 30 to 60,000 people. So the biggest city at the time, Harappa, had at most 60,000 people. We didn't, even with their advanced urban design for the time, you couldn't cram a million people into a city at that point. You would have needed the infrastructure that would have been necessary to maintain that kind of population in an urban setting didn't exist at the time.
Yeah, I don't know what the boundaries of that city is. Is it like Los Angeles where it's 20 miles wide? You know, I just don't
know. You have to consider that whatever was considered living in that city, what they estimated the population between 30 and 60,000.
I'm interested to see, like, what was the entire human population, let's say, in 2000 BCE?
I'm
just Googling that now. It looks like it was population about 27 million.
27 million, yeah. So three million of them were in the Indus Valley civilization.
Wow. Yeah.
The Yamato Dynasty of Japan is the longest surviving dynasty, spanning 2,680 years from 660 BC to the present day. Is science? Amazing. Wow. One dynasty considered, you know, a contiguous rule for 2,680 years,
which is why I thought that was going to be.
That's a long time. That's surprising.
That's the emperor's family?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And China had more different dynasties that changed over time, but Japan, remarkably stable. All right, so that was our first science or fiction. Well done, Jay.
Good job, Jay. Kara.
Well, I got it right, but for the wrong reason.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Always still painful counts. To me. It's like an ice in my freaking heart. But when you get it right for the wrong reason, but right is right.
Guys, I'd like to say something. So we have been a podcast. This is our 16th year now.
Yeah,
right?
This is our 16th year.
For 16 years, we have broke 800 shows. What are we at now?
811.
811-sies.
We done now?
And for a very, very long time, we could not have continued if it weren't for the people that support the podcast, because it takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of human hours to do all the things that the SGU does. Our goal, of course, is to promote critical thinking and science education, get people interested in things that they may not have been normally exposed to. And one of the big drivers for us is simply meeting people in our email. When we receive emails from people explaining how the show itself, people listen to it and they like to hear friends talking and everything, but they really do absorb the content, and then they tell us how critical thinking applied to their life and it helped their life in tremendous ways. And it is a massive motivator for us to keep going. I just wanted to say that we appreciate all of you who contribute. We really do love and appreciate our patrons. We read Discord. We are on the live stream and reading the comments all the time. And I just want to let you know, like, personally, I have gotten to know many of you, and I'm excited about where we're coming from and where the SGU is going to. And I really look forward to just continuing the relationship that we have with you guys. I can't wait until we have a live event again. We were doing the extravaganza tour, which is essentially the SGU, right? It is all of us just trying to entertain people, but the stories that we come away from those events it's just amazing from our perspective to meet everyone. And we'll be here as long as you guys are here. So thank you. Thank you to every single one that's ever contributed to the SGU. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, really, this has been a fantastic ride. I try to imagine, like, what our lives would be like if this never happened.
Yeah.
It's really weird to think about that.
Boring.
Yeah, I was just saying, it certainly is, one of the most exciting, fulfilling things that just developed in our lives. Not by accident, but, it was through a tremendous amount of hard work that continues. But, the hard work is no guarantee that it is going to be a payoff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because a lot of people do stuff and it just doesn't go anywhere. I think we're partly very, very lucky that we just happened to back into this very early on in podcasting,
Because I think, you know, I see people doing projects now that are very valuable, but they just, you know, you can't build a community like we have because the space is filled, you know?
It's just, it's saturated. It's different.
Yeah, it's saturated. So you have to be sort of in the right place at the right time. So I think we're very lucky. And it was sort of the perfect marriage of we had the right set of skills, you know, at the right time, with the right opportunity. Yeah, it was just the right ingredients. It was like this capturing lightning in a bottle kind of phenomenon.
I
don't think we could manufacture it again if we tried. Like, there's no formula to it.
No, it's absolutely not. I mean, I think a big part of it was our existing friendship relationship. Yeah. But, you know, look, it's obvious that we really do love and respect critical thinking. And, mm-hmm. and you know, it's a philosophy that really hits all of us hard, you know, all of us. You know, it's not like some of us are here for any other reason. We're doing this because we want to change the world. I feel like it's ridiculously fortunate for us to have these, the people that we have in our community. When I read the Discord chats and everything, I mean, we have great people. We have we have very creative people. We have people that like really want to meet people and talk to each other and have relationships. And I feel like, what's that, Bob? You laughing at me again?
No, somebody just said, James Bruno said, you had us at Bob's hello on the first episode. So that's awesome. That was just an awesome quote.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we love that you guys are getting all that you are out of the show, and we get so much out of it, like you, like we just said. I mean, like, you know, George and I were just talking to each other, like, who knew that day we met that we'd be 13 years later, whatever, like
making meatballs
together.
Like a meatball.
Never occurred to me that the guy that made me cry at TAM was going to become like one of my creative partners and all of our And Kara, we interviewed at TAM. I got to be honest with you. When we interviewed you at TAM, I'm like, I really, really like her. Like, I really felt that we had synergy with you.
We had instant chemistry with you.
Yeah, but I tucked Kara in the back of my brain.
All of us did. We were like, she would be great on the show.
That may have been my first skeptical conference, too, was that first TAM for me. Because prior to that, you know, this wasn't my career. I was doing SciComm, but I had been an outspoken atheist. And so I had done a few conferences. People had asked me to come speak at atheist conventions. But I think TAM was the first time I ever spoke at a skeptic convention. I really hadn't been sort of in, I don't even know if I would consider myself to have been in the community per se. I was just meeting everybody. And so it was really great to meet you guys back then.
And, you know, again, we've met so many fantastic, as we've said many times, so many fantastic people. But George, you know, you're a brother to us now.
Oh my God.
You don't say that lightly, you know, what that means to us.
I appreciate it.
We really, really do mean it. It's
just, we appreciate you, George. I mean, you've done a lot for us as well. Like what you bring to the table, and when we do projects with you, like you have a level of professionalism in the work that you do.
Because we don't.
Part of our problem is we're brothers. You know, most of this, Evan has been, you know, friends. Evan is family now.
Evan's been our brother for a long time.
Jay, I'm proud of my professionalism.
You know, but I mean, I just—it is an amazing two-way street. You know, I just first off, I just love your humor. Your humor like tickles me. Just, you can't tell
we yet. Always end up—we always end up like doing this at the end. It's very, very sweet. It's very, very sweet. And it's like, like you said, Steve, I can't imagine what our lives would be like if not just for the podcasting, but if we hadn't sort of crossed paths and been doing all this kind of stuff. And yeah, it's I had this one question I want to ask you guys.
Okay.
Like as we get to the end here, my little deep philosophy, if we can for a second. I want you to picture yourselves 20 years from now. Mm-hmm. 20 years from now down the road, right? And I want you to think what you would tell yourself today. So Jay, who's 20 years older than he is right now, he's looking back at Jay right now. And what is that person saying to you? Bob, what is he saying? Kara, what is she saying to you right now, that person 20 years from now?
Work twice as hard as you think you are going to or need to, because what you're doing is really important. And just, you know, work yourself to get the message
out there.
Spend
more time at the office, basically?
Well, I mean, it doesn't even, you know, you could be, when I say twice as hard, like, you know, maybe spend more time planning and being intelligent and being clever. You know, because a lot of this is there's so much manual stuff that happens behind the scenes. Yeah. But I guess what I would be telling myself is, yes, it's the work is super important. Keep going. Work hard. Do what you got to do. This is important. You know, I'm not just pushing buttons at a factory. Like, you know, I take this very seriously. As much as this is fun and everything,
it's hard work and I really respect it. Mm-hmm. And I would kick myself. The old me would kick the younger me, be like, you're not working hard enough.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Bob, how about you?
But what's your, but that's your the old you would kick the you right now, Jay, is what you're saying, not the younger.
Yeah, I know. Cause when I look back, cause George is saying, when you look back on your, what you did, I would want my, I want to know when I'm 70 that I worked really freaking hard because my voice is on this side of a speaker that a lot of people are hearing. I owe those people to do hard work and respect them and not put shit in their face. You know what I mean? I have to do my job. I have to make these productions good. I have to keep, you know, the wheels turning. And if I get lazy, then the quality of everything goes down because my fingers are in everything now. So I owe a lot to the SGU. I gotta perform. And I want to, and I love it.
Who's next?
I'll go. All right. So I would tell myself two things. I would say, Bob, make sure you, because I often think of, like, say 20 years ago and think of, oh man, you know, I was, you know, it was in my 30s. I had, you know, my future in front of me, and I was hanging out with these people. And I think, I tend to look back and think of the great things that I had then, but don't have now. And I would tell myself, Bob, don't think of you looking back 20 years. Think of me in the 2040s, looking back at me now and thinking, Bob, you're so lucky now.
Yeah,
and appreciate what you have now, and love the people that you're with now, because you know you could take them for granted, and they won't be there. And in 20 years from now, you're going to be wishing that you were the way you are now, and with all the opportunity that I have now.
Yeah.
So I would tell myself that, and the second thing I would tell myself is exactly what stocks to buy.
Right. What about you, Kara?
I mean, it's funny because in some ways what I would say to myself is almost the opposite of what you said to yourself, Jay. It's sort of like, don't work so hard and spend more time with the people that you love and spend more time just in quiet reflection and not always doing, but just being. And I think, but also it's similar to what Bob said, which is, you know, so I'm 37. I'm working on my PhD. I'm doing TV work and I'm doing the podcast and I'm doing, you know, I'm seeing patients and it's a lot. And I think I would continue to remind myself of the things that I even try to today, which is you're alive right now. You're not on a journey to finishing so that then you can start your life. Yeah. Like, you are existing in the fullest sense of the term. So don't wait to exist. Experience the experiences that you can in this moment, because tomorrow is not guaranteed.
Evan, what do you got?
I would remind myself again that this is about people. This is about relationships. I mean, yes, it's about skepticism. It's about science. It's about so many other things, but it's about humanity and it's about the relationships we make along the way in life. And it's so important. That plus, do not forget that the podcast you're involved with is an intimate format. We are in the direct ears of the listeners. We are having essentially one-on-one or five-on-one conversations with that individual person. And there's few things, I think, in media, certainly social media and other things, that is more powerful or more influential and means more to people than these kinds of media events that we do through our podcast. And I know this because as a boy growing up, I listened to a lot of talk radio and what it meant to me then. And that was me plus the person on the broadcasting on that microphone. It was just me and them. And how powerful and influential that was to me. Don't lose sight of that. Remember that that's what's really super important here. It means a lot to a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Never lose sight of that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right, Evan. Yeah, it's like you feel, in a good way, we feel the weight of the people that email us, you know, and they say how much they need this, you know, like they're isolated people. I mean, we get emails from people asking us for like really life altering advice, and we got to be careful because it's like, we can't just go around telling people how to run their lives. But that person turned to us as a friend. And I feel that, man. We talk about that. We get an email and we're like, hey guys, you see that email we got today? Oh my God, what do we do? Do we even write back? Like, what can we do?
They write us and they say, it's like we know you.
Yeah.
And it's true. They do know us because of the format, because of what we've put together, because of the presentations that we've made. And we're honest. We are who we are. We're not playing characters of ourselves.
Yeah.
We are who we are.
Oh, right? Totally, yeah.
It's as genuine, I think, as it is.
Couldn't hide it. In 13 years, we couldn't have hidden it this
could
well.
Not, you know? You can't fake it. You cannot fake it. People cannot be fooled that way, at that intimate level.
Steve, what would you tell yourself?
You know, I mean, I think a lot of what everyone has said were things that I was thinking about, something along those lines. Of course, I don't know, because I'm assuming I would be giving myself some wisdom that I gained between now and then that I specifically don't know now. Otherwise, why would I bother having to tell myself? Mm-hmm. It's what would I imagine that would be?
Yeah.
And it can't be obviously not just information about the future. I know that's not what you're saying, but like what perspective, you know, might I have in 20 years? Yeah. I can only extrapolate from like as Bob was doing, like from now to my younger self. And I don't know. I mean, I think I'm kind of, I agree with Kara. It's like, I always try to be happy doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm very mindful of the fact that, like, there are things that I appreciate in my life today that I won't always have. You know, like, when my daughters were young, and they were, like, 2 and 5, you know, I'm like, shit, man, I'm going to miss this. Because they are adorable.
Yeah.
I love them. And now I miss it. I knew exactly as much as I knew. But of course, I have now adult daughters that I love, and they're part of my life.
And they're pains in the asses now, though, you know?
I know, but I look at a picture of my daughter when she was 4, it's like, I miss that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. One day back then.
But you can't live that way. You got to, you know, again, you got to live in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I hope I reinforce that that's just, I agree with Jay. I think also, like where we are with the SGU, I wonder where it's going to be in 20 years because I like this. You know, this, I love this. I have to say, just getting together with all you guys, people that I love, people who share my worldview, share my mission. Again, this, as we were talking about earlier, Kara, the universe is meaningless. We make our own meaning. Well, this is what we're doing. We are making our own meaning here, and we're sharing it with a lot of people, which, of course, makes it have a much huger impact and meaning. You know, again, if we were doing this by our, you know, like nobody was interested in what we had to say, it'd be, you know, I'd still believe what I believe, but it would, you know, wouldn't be the same thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And I know, I just, you know, again, I love being part of this community, you know, the people that we were able to meet through it, and dealing with people in every facet that we do it. I wonder, you know, again, like Jay, am I making the most out of it now that I really can be? I'm kind of happy with the way everything's going right now, I have to say. Mm-hmm. But I'm always thinking about, what am I not doing that I should be doing?
Yeah.
You know? Maybe I would tell myself whatever that thing is that I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I'm like, all this new social media, I have no clue.
Like, what I would say, get on that TikTok.
Tactical
information.
Two fake words, TikTok.
Yeah, two words.
Because as you're working, as you're living your life, the world is changing.
Yeah.
And as you get older, you change slower. You know, you just kind of become a slower creature, you know?
Well, but there's there's some really good evidence to point to the fact that there's a developmental stage. I might have mentioned this on the show. It's called Gerost transcendence, and it happens in late life. Early developmental psychologists love to focus on children and how quickly they change and grow psychologically. And then, you know, up until a point, it was like, and then you become an adult, and then you're just the same until you die. And you know, slowly but surely, researchers started to realize, no, a lot happens in adulthood, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
And right? And gerotranscendence is a stage of older adulthood in which we start to kind of decouple from some of the constraints of culture and society. We spend more time contemplating, we pull away from having a ton of friends, and we just don't give as much of a shit about keeping up with the way that culture is shifting so quickly.
And we're happier
because we don't care about the superficial stuff. We're thinking about mortality. We're thinking about the true meaning in the world. We commune with nature more, and we spend more time contemplating and meditating. And it happens to a lot of people as they get older, and they are, you know, the people who kind of have those features are more often the people who say that they have really high quality of life, that they look back, they have very few regrets, and they're happy with who they are and where they've gone.
George, you're not off the hook, man.
What do you got, George?
Well, two things. I mean, I think I would say floss.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think I would seriously be like, just take care of, and that means everything.
Everything.
That is everything. That means like take care of.
Don't neglect yourself.
Yeah. It's very important. Yeah.
And I know this might come across in a strange way, but I think I would try to convince myself that I'm awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's wonderful.
Because you struggle with that, right?
Very much.
Which is always something.
Yeah, I want to tell my 20-year-old, you know, my 30-year-old self, dude, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. You're like, mm-hmm. you're doing great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're doing great. You know, like that, I think it would be hard for me to hear it. I don't think I'd believe myself, even though it was a future me.
I know, but even like when you and I have talked and you've thrown compliments my way and I'm like, you know, I could. And Ian, I can't compliment. The guy will punch me in the face if I lay on a compliment too heavy. I think.
So we got to go.
But don't you think, it's kind of part of the humility. We're humble people, you know, and it's good and bad because there's people that don't have as much humility as we do, but they go so much farther because they're not tuning themselves down. And
It's a weird.
There's a big difference, though, between humility towards others and accepting the self kind of efficacy and the self care and the self love that you need to accept.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to say like, oh, stop, I don't want to hear it. It's another thing to really not want to hear it because it makes you feel uncomfortable. And what we want to work on is being able to say, go on.
It's like, I mean, being brought up, I had a very great childhood and I had a very supportive childhood in many, many ways. But there wasn't always that element of like, it's okay. Like, you're okay. You're doing great.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of like, okay, all right, okay.
Yeah, keep going.
Okay. What else, you know? Which it drives the engine. It drives the engine on so many levels in terms of like what you're talking about. Yeah. Am I doing enough? You know, let's make this better. Let's rewrite the thing again. And I really think my 70-year-old self, which I can't even imagine that, to say that, you know, I'm going to be 50 in June. My 70-year-old self would say like, it's okay. You're awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a matter. You get to a point, and I do think this is better at least as I get older, I feel like I get more comfortable with this, is like not caring what other people think. That doesn't mean you don't value what other people think.
It's such an equation. Right. That's good.
It's different. I value that the opinions of people I respect, obviously, and just generally speaking.
I'm sorry, Steve. What you're saying matters so much. But we have a guest in the studio.
And it ends there.
We have 1 minute left.
But
I have to thank.
I'm going
to
finish my thought, and then we'll thank everybody.
Go ahead.
You know, the point, this is all just about self-esteem, right? Yeah. At some point you realize that I'm not going to live or die by what some asshole thinks of me, you know? Or just the thing,
Some great person thinks of you.
Or even that, it's beyond that. It's like everybody's dealing with their own shit.
Yeah. And most often what they think about you is more a reflection of what they think about themselves as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's more, what they think is more about them than you.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm interested in what other people think and I incorporate that into constructive feedback for myself and whatever. But emotionally, I think it's good to sort of disconnect from that. And like, if you think you're a good person and you have, again, you have a process and you are self-reflective, it's okay to think I'm a good person. You know, I'm successful. I'm a hard worker. I'm reliable, whatever. And not feel like you have to, to inflate your ego or to be
live up to something.
Yeah, to live up to something else. Just to be secure in yourself.
Yeah.
And it is very empowering, mm-hmm. and it's also just emotionally very, I think, healthy.
But you can't disconnect. You know, it's like any kind of thing that's in your head like that. It's like anxiety or depression. Yeah. You can't just go, hey, cut it out. And you're like, okay,
I'm not saying that.
I'm just talking about how trapped we all are in our own
psychology. That's cognitive behavioral therapy, though, Jay. You can do this. I'm saying, you can do this cognitive therapy. And I think this is part of the reason why as people get older, they tend to get happier. Because they start to realize, like Kara was saying, you don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah.
And you're not so emotionally crippled by what other people think of you. And it's very liberating.
It is.
But in any case, you know, I do feel very positively about the skeptical movement, about our approach to life. I think it's very positive and very important, increasingly important. I feel very lucky to be part of it.
Yeah, me too.
You know, whatever the end result of what happens, it's still like looking back and saying, I spent a large chunk of my life trying to make the world a more skeptical place. I feel good about that.
Yeah, it's time well spent.
Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
It was
guys.
A lot of fun. Actually, the 12 hours went by super fast, as we knew it would be.
It really did.
To a small fraction of the content prepared for you.
We love you guys.
Thanks,
we
guys.
Love you.
We
very
do. We
much.
Appreciate
Thank you so much.
We appreciate all of our listeners and all of our patrons.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
See you at the live stream next.
Good
Friday.
Night. Thank you.
Bye.
Hey, everyone. This is Steve coming in at the end with just a quick announcement. We actually have a save the date for Nexus 2021. That's the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. This will be another all-digital conference. You can check out the page at necss.org. And the date is August 6th and 7th. So we'll have a live streaming Nexus Friday, August 6th to Saturday, August 7th. Check out the website for new details as they become available. Thanks again for listening to what essentially is the highlight reel of our 12-hour live stream. If you want to watch the whole thing, there's a lot of parts of it that included visual stuff, which we, you know, I saved for, you know, the visual part of the show. If you want to watch it, it's all on YouTube. So just look at the Skeptics Guide YouTube channel. All 12 hours of the live stream is there for you to watch. And until next week, this is your Skeptics Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.